5 months old. I felt sick to leave her, but I would have felt sick to stay with her and not work, she explains. She forced herself to face down this guilt, and then let it go. Let's just feel guilty and go on living, she told herself. Anyway, she adds, reassuring both of us, the perfect mother doesn't exist. What really fortifies French women against guilt is their conviction that it's unhealthy for mothers and children to spend all their time together. They believe there's a risk of smothering kids with attention and anxiety, or of developing the dreaded relation fusionnelle, where a mother's and a child's needs are too intertwined. Children, even babies and toddlers, get to cultivate their inner lives without a mother's constant interference. If your child is your only goal in life, it's not good for the child, Danielle says. What happens to the child if he's the only hope for his mother? I think this is the opinion of all psychoanalysts. This separation can go too far. When French Justice Minister Rachida Dati went back to work 5 days after giving birth to her daughter, Zora, there was a collective gasp from the French press. In a survey by the French edition of Elle magazine, 42% of respondents described Dati as too careerist. There was less controversy about the fact that Dati was a 43-year-old single mother and that she wouldn't name the father. When we Americans talk about work-life balance, we're describing a kind of juggling where we're trying to keep all parts of our lives in motion without screwing up any of them too badly. The French also talk about l'équilibre, but they mean it differently. For them, it's about not letting any one part of life, including parenting, overwhelm the rest. It's more like a balanced meal where there's a good mix of proteins, carbohydrates, fruits, vegetables, and sweets. In that sense, the careerist Rachida Dati had the same problem as stay-at-home moms, a life too heavily weighted toward one element. Of course, for some French mothers, l'équilibre is just an ideal. But at least it's a calming ideal. When I asked my Parisian friend Esther, who works full-time as a lawyer, to assess herself as a mother, she says something that I find breathtaking in its simplicity and the lack of neurotic tension. In general, I don't doubt whether I'm good enough, because I really think I am. Inès de la Froissange isn't an ordinary French woman. In the 1980s, she was Karl Lagerfeld's muse and main model at Chanel. Then de la Froissange was asked to be the new face of Marianne, the symbol of the French Republic, who appears on stamps and on busts in town halls. Past Mariannes have included Brigitte Bardot and Catherine Deneuve. De la Froissange and Lagerfeld parted ways after she accepted. He allegedly said he didn't want to dress a monument. Now in her early 50s, de la Froissange is still a doe-eyed, languid brunette whose long legs don't seem to fit under cafe tables. She's had her own eponymous fashion label and occasionally still walks the runway. In 2009, readers of Madame Figaro voted her the best embodiment of the Parisian woman. De la Froissange is also a mother. Her two equally leggy and photogenic daughters, the teenaged Nine and tween-aged Violette, have already launched their own fashion and modeling careers. De la Froissange used to make light of her own charms by calling herself the swarthy asparagus. She says she's an imperfect mother, too. I forget about morning yoga, and I always put on lip gloss and mascara in the car mirror. What's important is to rid yourself of guilt over not being perfect. Obviously, de la Froissange isn't typical, but she incarnates a certain French ideal about striking a balance. In an interview with Paris Match, she describes how 3 years after her husband died, she met a man at a ski resort in the French Alps where she was vacationing with her daughters. The man just happened to be the head of one of France's most important magazines and a recipient of the French Legion of Honor. De la Froissange wasn't Lagerfeld's muse for nothing. She put off her suitor for a few months, explaining that she wasn't ready. But as she tells Paris Match, finally, it was me who called him to say, okay, I'm a mother, and a working girl, but also a woman. For the girls, I thought it was good to have a mother in love. Chapter 9. Kaka Buddha. When Bean is about 3, she starts using an expression I've never heard before. At first I think it's Kaka Buddha, which sounds like it could be vaguely offensive to my Buddhist friends. As in English, kaka is a French kid's term for poop. But after a while I realize she's saying Kaka Buddha. Buddha means sausage. My daughter is going around shouting, if you'll pardon my French, poop sausage. Like all good curse words, Kaka Buddha is versatile. Bean shouts it gleefully when she's running through the house with her friends. She also uses it to mean, whatever, leave me alone, and none of your business. It's an all-purpose retort. Me. What did you do at school today? Bean. Kaka Buddha. Snortle. Me. Would you like some more broccoli? Bean. Kaka Buddha. Hysterical laughter. Simon and I aren't sure what to make of Kaka Buddha. Is it rude or cute? Should we be angry or amused? We don't understand the social context, and we have no childhood experience of our own in France to draw on. To be safe, we tell her to stop saying it. She compromises by continuing to say it, but then adding, "We don't say Kaka Buddha. It's a bad word." Bean's budding French does have perks. When we go back to America for Christmas, my mother's friends keep asking her to pronounce the name of her hairdresser, Jean-Pierre, with her Parisian accent. Jean-Pierre has given her a pixie haircut that they coo is oh so French too. Bean is happy to sing, on demand, some of the dozens of French songs she's learned in school. I'm amazed the first time she opens a present and says spontaneously, "Oh la la!" But it's becoming clear that being bilingual is more than just a party trick or a neutral skill. As Bean's French improves, she's starting to bring home not just unfamiliar expressions, but also new ideas and rules. Her new language is making her into not just a French speaker, but into a French person. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. I'm not even sure what a French person is. The main way that France enters our house is through school. Bean has started École Maternelle, France's free public preschool. It's all day, 4 days a week, except for Wednesdays. Maternelle isn't compulsory, and kids can go part-time, but pretty much every 3-year-old in France goes to maternelle full-time and has a similar experience there. It's France's way of turning toddlers into French people. The maternelle has lofty goals. It is, in effect, a national project to turn the nation's solipsistic 3-year-olds into civilized, empathetic people. A booklet for parents from the Education Ministry explains that in maternelle, kids discover the richness and the constraints of the group that they're part of. They feel the pleasure of being welcomed and recognized, and they progressively participate in welcoming their fellow students. Charlotte, who's been a teacher at maternelle for 30 years and still charmingly has the kids call her maîtresse, teacher or, literally, mistress, tells me that in the first year the kids are very egotistical. "They don't realize that the teacher is there for everyone," she says. Conversely, the pupils only gradually understand that when the teacher speaks to the group, what she's saying is also intended for each of them individually. Kids typically do activities of their choosing in groups of 3 or 4, at separate tables or parts of the classroom. To me, maternelle seems like art school for short people. During Bean's first year, the walls of her classroom are quickly covered in students' drawings and paintings. Being able to perceive, feel, imagine, and create are goals of maternelle, too. The children learn to raise their hands, à la française, with one finger pointed up in the air. I was worried about enrolling Bean. The creche was a big romper room. Maternelle is a bit more like school. The classes are big, and I've been warned that parents get very little information on what goes on. One American mom tells me she stopped asking her daughter's teacher for feedback after the teacher eventually explained, "If I don't say anything, that means she's fine." Bean's first-year teacher is a glum woman whose only comment about Bean the entire year is that she's very calm. Bean adores this teacher and loves her classmates. And despite all the painting and drawing, there's a lot of emphasis on learning to follow instructions. Bean's first year, I'm jarred to see that the whole class usually paints exactly the same thing. One morning, there are 25 identical yellow stick figures with green eyes hanging up in the classroom. As someone who can't write anything without a deadline, or two, I recognize the need for some constraints. But seeing all those nearly identical pictures is unsettling. Bean's second year artwork is more freeform. It takes me a while to realize that in Bean's classroom the first year, there isn't even an alphabet on the wall alongside all the artwork. At a meeting for parents, no one mentions reading. There's more fuss about feeding lettuce to the classroom's tank of escargot, tiny ones, not to be eaten. In fact, as I'll discover, kids aren't taught to read in maternelle, which lasts until the year they turn six. They just learn letters, sounds, and how to write their own names. I'm told that some kids pick up reading on their own, though I couldn't say which ones, since their parents don't mention it. Learning to read isn't part of the French curriculum until the equivalent of first grade, the year that kids turn seven. This relaxed attitude goes against my most basic American belief that earlier is better. But even the most upwardly mobile parents of Bean's school friends aren't in any rush. "I prefer that they don't spend time learning to read now," Marion, herself a journalist, tells me. She and her husband say that at this stage, it's much more important for children to learn social skills, how to organize their thoughts, and how to speak well. They're in luck. While reading isn't taught at maternelle, speaking definitely is. In fact, it turns out that the main goal of maternelle is for kids of all backgrounds to perfect their spoken French. A booklet for parents produced by the French government says this French should be rich, organized, and comprehensible to others. That is, they need to speak it much better than I do. Charlotte, the teacher, tells me that children of immigrants typically enter maternelle in September speaking bare-bones French, or none at all. By March, they're usually competent, if not fluent. The French logic seems to be that if children can speak clearly, they can also think clearly. In addition to polishing their spoken grammar, the government's booklet says a French child learns to observe, ask questions, and make his interrogations increasingly rational. He learns to adopt a point of view other than his own, and this confrontation with logical thinking gives him a taste of reasoning. He becomes capable of counting, of classifying, ordering, and describing. All those philosophers and intellectuals I see pontificating on evening television in France apparently began their analytical training in preschool. I'm grateful for the maternelle. I haven't forgotten that my friends back in the United States, even if they're not buying baby literacy DVDs, are battling to get their kids into private preschools that can cost $12,000 a year for just half-day sessions. I meet a mother from New Jersey who drives 50 minutes to drop off her twin daughters at their preschool. By the time she gets home, she has enough time to shower and toss in some laundry before she has to go pick them up. It's not just the well-off who are overwhelmed by childcare costs. In a study showing how much money an American couple with two young kids needs for basic economic security, childcare is the top expense. The French maternelle is far from perfect. Teachers effectively have tenure, whether they're any good or not. There are chronic funding problems and the occasional shortage of places. Bean's class has 25 kids, which feels like quite a lot but isn't even the maximum. There's a teacher's assistant who helps with supplies, bathroom runs, and general wrangling. On the plus side, the only thing I regularly pay for at maternelle is lunch. The cost is on a sliding scale ranging from 13 cents to 5 euros per day, based on parents' income. The school is a 7-minute walk from our house, and the maternelle makes it very easy for mothers to work. It's in session from 8:20 to 4:20, 4 days a week. For another small fee, there's a leisure center on the premises that can look after kids until the early evening and all day on Wednesdays. The leisure center is also open on many school holidays and during much of the summer, when they take the kids to parks and museums. Maternelle is clearly a big part of what's turning my little American girl into a French person. It's even making me more French. Unlike at the crèche, the other parents immediately take an interest in Bean and, by association, in me. They now seem to view our family as part of the cohort that they'll be traveling all through school with, whereas after the crèche, the kids scattered to different schools. A few of the mothers from Bean's class have little babies and are out on maternity leave. When I pick up Bean from school and bring her to the park across the street, I sit with some of these women while our kids play. Gradually, we're even invited over to their homes for birthday parties, afternoon goûters, and dinners. While the maternelle brings us all more into French life, it also makes us realize that French families observe social codes that we don't. After dinner at the home of my friend Esther and her husband, who have a daughter Bean's age, Esther becomes agitated because the little girl won't come out of her room to say goodbye to us. Esther finally marches into the girl's room and drags her out.
Au revoir,
the 4-year-old says meekly. Esther is soothed. Of course I'd been making Bean say the magic words please and thank you. But it turns out that in French there are 4 magic words, s'il vous plaît, please, merci, thank you, bonjour, hello, and au revoir, goodbye. Please and thank you are necessary, but not nearly sufficient. Bonjour and au revoir, and bonjour in particular, are crucial. I hadn't realized that learning to say bonjour is a central part of becoming French. Me, my obsession is that my children know to say merci, bonjour, bonjour, madame. Audrey Guttard, the French journalist with 3 kids, tells me, from the age of 1, you can't imagine. I said it to them 15 times a day. For some French parents, a simple bonjour isn't enough. They should say it with confidence. It's the first part of a relationship, another mother tells me. Virginie, the skinny stay-at-home mom, demands that her kids heighten the politeness by saying bonjour monsieur and bonjour madame. My friend Esther insists on bonjours at the threat of punishment. If she doesn't say bonjour, she stays in her room. No dinner with guests, Esther explains. So she says bonjour. It's not the most sincere bonjour, but it's a repetition, I'm hoping. Benoit, a professor and father of 2, tells me there was a family crisis when he took his kids to stay with their grandparents. His 3-year-old daughter would wake up grumpy and didn't want to say bonjour to her grandfather until she'd had breakfast. She finally compromised by agreeing to say, pas bonjour papi, not good morning, grandpa, to him on the way to the table. He was happy with that, in the way she was acknowledging him, Benoit explains. Adults are supposed to say bonjour to each other too, of course. I think tourists are often treated gruffly in Parisian cafes and shops, partly because they don't begin interactions with bonjour, even if they switch to English afterward. It's crucial to say bonjour upon climbing into a taxi, when a waitress first approaches your table in a restaurant, or before asking a salesperson if the pants come in your size. Saying bonjour acknowledges the other person's humanity. It signals that you view her as a person, not just as someone who's supposed to serve you. I'm amazed that people seem visibly put at ease after I say a nice solid bonjour. It signals that, although I have a strange accent, we're going to have a civilized encounter. In the United States, a 4-year-old American kid isn't obliged to greet me when he walks into my house. He gets to skulk in under the umbrella of his parents' greeting. And in an American context, that's supposed to be fine with me. I don't need the child's acknowledgement because I don't quite count him as a full person. He's in a separate kid's realm. I might hear all about how gifted he is, but he never actually speaks to me. When I'm at a family luncheon back in the United States, I'm struck that the cousins and step-cousins at the table, who range in age from 5 to 14, don't say anything at all to me unless I pry it out of them. Some can only muster 1-word responses to my questions. Even the teenagers aren't used to expressing themselves with confidence to a grown-up they don't know well. Part of what the French obsession with bonjour reveals is that, in France, kids don't get to have this shadowy presence. The child greets. Therefore, he is. Just as any adult who walks into my house has to acknowledge me, any child who walks in must acknowledge me too. Greeting is essentially recognizing someone as a person, says Benoit, the professor. People feel injured if they're not greeted by children that way. These aren't just social conventions. They're a national project. In a meeting for parents at Bean School, her teacher says that one of the school's goals is for students to remember the names of adults, Bean calls her teachers by their first names, and to practice saying bonjour, au revoir, and merci to them. The booklet by the French government says that in maternelle, kids are supposed to show their grasp of civility and politeness, including greeting the teacher at the beginning and the end of the day, responding to questions, thanking the person who helps him, and not cutting someone off when they're speaking. French children don't always succeed in saying bonjour. Often there's a little ritual in which the parent pushes the child to say it. Comme c'est bonjour! The adult who's being greeted waits a beat, and then tells the parent in a friendly way not to worry about it. This seems to satisfy the obligation, too. Making kids say bonjour isn't just for the benefit of grown-ups. It's also to help kids learn that they're not the only ones with feelings and needs. It avoids selfishness, says Esther, who dragged out her daughter, an adorable, doted-on only child, to say goodbye to me. Kids who ignore people and don't say bonjour or au revoir, they just stay in their bubble. Since parents are dedicated to them already, when will they get the sense that they are there to give, not just to receive? Saying please and thank you puts children in an inferior receiving role. An adult has either done something for them or the child is asking the adult to do something. But bonjour and au revoir put the child and the adult on more equal footing, at least for that moment. It cements the idea that kids are people in their own right. I can't help thinking that letting an American kid slink in the door without greeting me could set off a chain reaction in which she then jumps on my couch, refuses to eat anything but plain pasta, and bites my foot while I'm having dinner. If she's exempt from that first rule of civility, she, and everyone else, will be quicker to assume that she's exempt from many other rules too, or that she's not capable of following these rules. Saying bonjour signals to the child, and to everyone else, that she's capable of behaving well. It sets the tone for the whole interaction between adults and children. Parents acknowledge that greeting someone is in some ways an adult act. I don't think it's easy to say hello, says Denise, a medical ethicist with two girls, ages 7 and 9. But Denise says it fortifies kids to know that their greeting matters to the adult. She explains, I think the child who doesn't say bonjour cannot really feel confident. Neither can the child's parents. That's because saying bonjour is also a strong marker of upbringing. Kids who don't say the French magic words risk being slapped with the label mal élevé, badly brought up. Denise says her younger daughter had a friend over who shouted quite a lot and jokingly called Denise chérie, darling. I told my husband I will not invite him back, she tells me. I don't want my child to play with children who are badly brought up. Audrey Guttard, the journalist, has written a book called Le Grand Livre de la Famille, in which she tries to upend some French parenting conventions. But even Guttard doesn't dare question the importance of bonjour. Honestly, in France, a child who arrives somewhere and doesn't say bonjour, monsieur, bonjour, madame, is a child that one rejects, she tells me. A 6-year-old who doesn't look up from the TV when you come in at the France house, I'm going to say that he is badly raised. I won't say that he's normal. We're a society with a lot of codes, and this code, if you don't follow it, you're excluded from society. It's as stupid as that. So you give your kids less of a chance to be integrated, to meet people. I say in my book that it's better that your kids know this code. Yikes. I'd vaguely noticed French kids saying bonjour, but I hadn't realized how much rests on it. It's the sort of signifier that having nice teeth is in the United States. When you say bonjour, it shows that someone has invested in your upbringing and that you're going to play by some basic social rules. Bean's cohort of 3- and 4-year-olds has already had several years' worth of bonjours drilled into them. Bean hasn't had any. With only please and thank you in her arsenal, she's at just 50%. She might have already earned the dreaded label, badly brought up. I try to appeal to the tiny anthropologist in her by explaining that bonjour is a native custom she has to respect. We live in France, and for French people it's very important to say bonjour, so we have to say it too, I say. I coach her in the elevator before we arrive at birthday parties and at visits to the homes of French friends. What are you going to say when we walk in? I ask anxiously.
Caca Buddha,
she says. Usually, when we walk in, she says nothing at all. So I go through the ritual of, very publicly, telling her to say bonjour. At least I'm acknowledging the convention. Maybe I'm even instilling the habit. One day while Bean and I are walking to her school, she spontaneously turns to me and says,
even if I'm shy, I have to say bonjour.
Maybe it's something she picked up in school. Anyway, it's true, and it's good that she knows it. But I can't help worrying that she's internalizing the rules a bit too much. It's one thing to play at being French. It's quite another to really go native. Although I'm ambivalent about Bean growing up French, I'm thrilled that she's growing up bilingual. Simon and I speak only English to her, and at school, she speaks only French. I'm sometimes astonished that I've given birth to a child who can effortlessly pronounce phrases like carottes râpées and confiture sur le beurre. I thought that young kids just pick up languages, but it's more like a long process of trial and error. A few people tell me that Bean's French still has an American twang. And though Bean has never lived outside the Paris Ring Road, thanks to us, she evidently radiates some kind of Americanness. When I take her to her Wednesday morning music class one day, the babysitter usually takes her, I discover that the teacher has been speaking to Bean in pidgin English, though she speaks French to all the other children. Later, a dance teacher tells the class of little girls, in French, to lie down flat on the floor, comme une crêpe, like a crepe. Then she turns to Bean and says, comme une pancake. At first, even I can tell that Bean is making lots of mistakes in French and coming up with some bizarre constructions. She usually says the English for instead of its French equivalent pour, and she knows only the vocabulary that she's learned in the classroom, which doesn't really equip her to talk about cars or dinner. One day she suddenly asks me, avion is the same as airplane? She's figuring it out. I'm not sure which mistakes come from being bilingual and which come from being 3 or 4 years old. One day in the metro, Bean leans into me and says,
you smell like vomila.
This turns out to be a combination of vomit and Pamela. A minute later, Bean leans into me again. What do I smell like now? I ask.
Like college, she says.
At home, some French expressions edge out the English ones. We start saying cuckoo instead of peekaboo and gee gee when we tickle her instead of coochie coochie coo. Bean doesn't play hide and seek, she plays cache cache. We put our garbage in the poubelle. Her pacifier is a tétine. No one in our household farts. They make proutes, rhymes with roots. By the spring of Bean's first year in maternelle, friends tell me that her American twang is gone. She sounds like a genuine Parisienne. She's become so confident in French that I overhear her joking around with friends, in French, in an exaggerated American accent, probably mine. She likes to mix up the two accents on purpose, and decides that the French word for sprinkles must be sprinkles. Me. How do you say d'accord in English? Bean.
You know,
sounding like an Alabaman.
D'accord!
My father finds the idea of having a French grandchild charming. He tells Bean to call him grand-père. Bean doesn't even consider doing this. She knows he's not French. She just calls him grandpa. At night, Bean and I look at picture books. She's excited and relieved to confirm that, as with airplane, certain words in French and English refer to the same thing. When we read the famous line in the Madeleine books, something is not right. She translates it into colloquial French. Quelque chose ne va pas. Although Simon has an English accent, Bean's English sounds mostly American. I'm not sure if that's my influence or Elmo's. The other Anglophone kids we know in Paris all have their own accents. Bean's friend, the dad from New Zealand, and a mother who's half Irish, sounds full-on British. A boy with a Parisian mother and a Californian dad sounds like a French chef from 1970s American television. The little boy around the corner with a Farsi-speaking father and an Australian mom just sounds like a creaky Muppet. In English, Bean occasionally emphasizes the wrong syllables of words, the second syllable of salade, for example, and she sometimes puts English sentences into a French word order. Me, I'm not going to have an injection, me. Or translates literally from French to English, because it's like that. She tends to say after, when what she means is later. In French, they're the same word, après. Sometimes Bean just doesn't know how native English speakers talk. In a weird appropriation of all the Disney Princess DVDs she's been watching, when she wants to know if something looks good on her, she simply asks, "Am I the fairest?" These are all small things. There's nothing that a summer at an American sleepaway camp won't fix. Another French word that infiltrates our English vocabulary is bêtise. It means a small act of naughtiness. When Bean stands up at the table, grabs an unauthorized piece of candy, or pitches a pea on the floor, we say that she's doing a bêtise. Bêtises are minor annoyances. They're bad, but they're not that bad. The accumulation of many of them may warrant a punishment, but just one bêtise on its own probably doesn't. We've appropriated the French word because there's no good English translation of bêtise. In English, you wouldn't tell a child that he's committed a small act of naughtiness. We tend to label the kid, rather than the crime, by telling him that he's being naughty, misbehaving, or just being bad. These phrases don't really show the severity of the act. Of course, in English, I know the difference between hitting the table and hitting a person. But being able to label an offense as a misdemeanor, a mere bêtise, helps me as a parent to respond appropriately. I don't have to freak out and crack down every time Bean does something wrong or challenges my authority. Sometimes, it's just a bêtise. Having this word calms me down. I acquire much of my new French vocabulary not just from Bean, but from the many French kids' books we somehow end up owning, thanks to birthday parties, impulse purchases, and neighbors' garage sales. I'm careful not to read to Bean in French if there's a native speaker within earshot. I can hear my American accent and the way I stumble over the odd word. Usually, I'm trying so hard not to mispronounce anything too egregiously that I grasp the storyline only on the third reading. I soon notice that French and English kids' books and songs aren't just in different languages. Often they have very different storylines and moral messages. In the American books, there's usually a problem, a struggle to fix the problem, and then a cheerful resolution. The spoon wishes that she were a fork or a knife, but eventually realizes how great it is to be a spoon. The boy who wouldn't let the other kids play in his box is then excluded from the box himself and realizes that all the kids should play in the box together. Lessons are learned and life gets better. It's not just the books. I notice how deliriously hopeful I sound when I sing to Bean about how if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, and when you're watching a DVD of the musical Annie, how the sun'll come out tomorrow. In the English-speaking world, every problem seems to have a solution, and prosperity is just around the corner. The French books I read to Bean start out with a similar structure. There's a problem, and the characters struggle to overcome that problem, but they seldom succeed for very long. Often the book ends with the protagonist having the same problem again. There is rarely a moment of personal transformation when everyone learns and grows. One of Bean's favorite French books is about two pretty little girls who are cousins and best friends. Aliette, the redhead, is always bossing around Alice, the brunette. One day, Alice decides she can't take it anymore and stops playing with Aliette. There's a long, lonely standoff. Finally, Elliette comes to Alice's house, begging her pardon and promising to change. Alice accepts the apology. A page later, the girls are playing doctor and Elliette is trying to jab Alice with a syringe. Nothing has changed. The end. Not all French kids' books end this way, but a lot of them do. The message is that endings don't have to be tidy to be happy. It's a cliché about Europeans, but you can see it in the morals of Bean's French stories. Life is ambiguous and complicated. There aren't bad guys and good guys. Each of us has a bit of both. Elliette is bossy, but she's also lots of fun. Alice is the victim, but she also seems to ask for it, and she goes back for more. We're to presume that Elliette and Alice keep up their little dysfunctional cycle because, well, that's what a friendship between two girls is like. I wish I had known that when I was 4, instead of finally figuring it out in my 30s. Writer Deborah Olivier points out that American girls pick the petals off daisies saying, "He loves me, he loves me not." Whereas little French girls allow for more subtle varieties of affection saying, "He loves me a little, a lot, passionately, madly, not at all." Characters in French kids' books can have contradictory qualities. In one of Bean's Perfect Princess books, Zoé opens a present and declares that she doesn't like it. But on the next page, Zoé is a perfect princess who jumps up and says merci to the gift giver. If there were an American version of this book, Zoé would probably overcome her bad habits and morph fully into the perfect princess. The French book is more like real life. Zoé continues to struggle with both sides of her personality. The book tries to encourage princess-like habits. There's a little certificate at the end for good behavior, but takes for granted that kids also have a built-in impulse to do bêtises. There's also a lot of nudity and love in French books for 4-year-olds. Bean has a book about a boy who accidentally goes to school naked. She has another about a romance between the boy who accidentally pees in his pants and the little girl who lends him her pants while fashioning her bandana into a skirt. These books, and the French parents I know, treat the crushes and romances of preschoolers as genuine. I get to know a few people who grew up in France with American parents. When I ask whether they feel French or American, they almost all say that it depends on the context. They feel American when they're in France, and French when they're in America. Bean seems headed for something similar. I'm able to transmit some American traits, like whining and sleeping badly, with little effort, but others require a lot of work. I begin picking off certain American holidays, based mainly on the amount of cooking each one requires. Halloween is a keeper. Thanksgiving is out. 4th of July is close enough to Bastille Day, July 14th, that I sort of feel like we're celebrating both. I'm not sure what constitutes classically American food, but I'm strangely adamant that Bean should like tuna melts. Making Bean feel a bit American is hard enough. On top of that, I'd also like her to feel Jewish. Though I put her on the no pork list at school, this apparently isn't enough to cement her religious identity. She keeps trying to get a grip on what this strange anti-Santa label means and how she can get out of it.
"I don't want to be Jewish. I want to be British," she announces in early December.
I'm reluctant to mention God. I fear that telling her there's an omnipotent being everywhere, including presumably in her room, would terrify her. She's already afraid of witches and wolves. Instead, in the spring, I prepare an elegant Passover dinner. Halfway through the first benediction, Bean begs to leave the table. Simon sits at the far end with a sullen, "I told you so," look. We slurp our matzo ball soup, then turn on some Dutch football. Hanukkah is a big success. The fact that Bean is 6 months older probably helps. So do the candles and the presents. What really wins Bean over is that we sing and dance the Hora in our living room, then collapse in a dizzy circle. But after 8 nights of this and 8 carefully selected presents, she's still skeptical.
"Hanukkah is over. We're not Jewish anymore," she tells me.
She wants to know whether Father Christmas, a.k.a. the Père Noël she's been hearing about in school, will be coming to our house. On Christmas Eve, Simon insists on setting out shoes with presents in front of our fireplace.
He claims he's loosely following the Dutch cultural tradition, not the religious one. The Dutch put out shoes on December 5th. Bean is ecstatic when she wakes up and sees the shoes, even though the only thing in them is a cheap yo-yo and some plastic scissors.
Père Noël doesn't usually visit the Jewish children, but he came to our house this year, she chirps.
After that, when I pick her up at school, our conversations usually go something like this. Me: what did you do at school today? Bean:
I ate pork.
As long as we're foreign, it's not a bad idea to be native English speakers. English is, of course, the language du jour in France. Most Parisians under 40 can speak it at least passably. Bean's teacher asks me and a Canadian dad to come in one morning to read some English language books out loud to the kids in Bean's class. Several of Bean's friends take English lessons. The parents coo about how lucky Bean is to be bilingual. But there's a downside to having foreign parents. Simon always reminds me that, as a child in Holland, he cringed when his parents spoke Dutch in public. I'm reminded of that when, at the year-end concert at Bean's preschool, parents are invited to join in for a few songs. Most of the other parents know the words. I mumble along, hoping that Bean doesn't notice. It's clear that I will have to compromise between the American identity I'd like to give Bean and the French one she is quickly absorbing. I get used to her calling Cinderella, Cendrillon, and Snow White, Blanche-Neige. I laugh when she tells me that a boy in her class likes Spider-Man, complete with a guttural R, instead of Spider-Man. But I draw the line when she claims that the seven dwarfs sing Hey Ho, as they do in the French voiceover. Some things are sacred. Luckily, it turns out that bits of Anglophone culture are irresistibly catchy. As I'm walking Bean to school one morning, through the glorious medieval streets of our neighborhood, she suddenly starts singing The Sun'll Come Out Tomorrow. We sing it together all the way to school. My hopeful little American girl is still in there. I finally decide to ask some French adults about this mysterious word, caca bouda. They're tickled that I'm taking caca bouda so seriously. It turns out that it is a swear word, but one that's just for little kids. They pick it up from each other around the time when they start learning to use the toilet. Saying caca bouda is a little bit of a bêtise, but parents understand that that's the joy of it. It's a way for kids to thumb their noses at the world and to transgress. The adults I speak to recognize that since children have so many rules and limits, they need some freedom too. Caca bouda gives kids power and autonomy. Bean's former teacher, Anne-Marie, smiles indulgently when I ask her about caca bouda.
It's part of the environment, she explains. We said it when we were little too.
That doesn't mean that children can say caca bouda whenever they want. The parenting guide, Votre Enfant, suggests telling kids they can only say bad words when they're in the bathroom. Some parents tell me they ban such words from the dinner table. They don't forbid kids from saying caca bouda. They teach them to wield it appropriately. When Bean and I visit a French family in Brittany, she and their little girl, Léonie, stick out their tongues at the little girl's grandmother. The grandmother immediately sits them down for a talk about when it's appropriate to do such things.
When you're alone in your room, you can. When you're alone in the bathroom, you can. You can go barefoot, stick out your tongue, point at someone, say, caca, bouda. You can do all that when you're by yourself. But when you're at school, no. When you're at the table, no. When you're with mommy and daddy, no. In the street, no. Celebi, you must understand the difference.
Once Simon and I learn more about caca bouda, we decide to lift our moratorium on it. We tell Bean that she can say it, but not too much. We like the philosophy behind it, and even occasionally say it ourselves. A curse word just for kids. How quaint. How French. In the end, I think the social complexities of caca bouda are too subtle for us to master. When the father of one of Bean's school friends comes to fetch his daughter at our house one Sunday afternoon after a play date, he hears Bean shouting, caca bouda, as she runs down the hall. The father, a banker, looks at me warily. I'm sure he mentions the incident to his wife. His daughter hasn't been back to our house since. Chapter 10 Double Entendre. So, I finished my book, and for about 15 glorious minutes before breakfast one morning, I'm within 100 grams of my target weight. I'm all ready to be pregnant. And yet, I'm not. Everyone around me is. There seems to be a last gasp of fertility among my friends who are, like me, in their late 30s. Getting pregnant with Bean was a bit like having a pizza delivered. You want one? Phone up and get one. It worked on the first try. But this time, there's no pizza. As the months go by, I feel the age gap between Bean and her theoretical, possibly counterfactual sibling widening. I don't feel like I have many months to spare. If I don't have the second baby soon, the third will become physically impossible. My doctor tells me that my cycle has become too long. She says the egg shouldn't be sitting on the shelf so long before it breaks through to reach a possible mate. She prescribes Clomid, which makes me release more eggs, upping the odds that one will stay fit enough. Meanwhile, more friends call me with their wonderful news. They're pregnant. I'm happy for them. Really, I am. After about 8 months, I get the name of an acupuncturist specializing in fertility. She has long black hair and a storefront in a low-end Parisian business district. Most cities have one Chinatown. Paris has 5 or 6. The acupuncturist studies my tongue, sticks some needles in my arms, and asks the length of my cycle.
That's too long,
she says, explaining that the egg is withering on the shelf. She writes me a prescription for a liquid potion that tastes like tree bark. I drink it dutifully. I don't get pregnant. Simon says he'd be happy with just one kid. Out of respect for him, I consider this possibility for about 4 seconds. Something primal is driving me. It doesn't feel Darwinian. It feels like a carbohydrate high. I want more pizza. I go back to my doctor and tell her I'm ready to up the ante. What else has she got? She doesn't think we need to go all the way to in vitro fertilization. France's national insurance pays for up to 6 rounds of IVF for women under age 43. Instead, she teaches me to inject myself in the thigh with a drug that will force me to ovulate earlier in my cycle, so the egg won't have time to wither. For this to work, I have to take the shot on day 14, and in a primitive twist, just after taking the shot, I must have sex. It turns out that at the next 14-day point, Simon will be in Amsterdam for work. For me, there's no question of waiting another month. I book a babysitter for Bean and arrange to meet Simon in Brussels, which is about halfway between Amsterdam and Paris. We plan to have a leisurely dinner and then retire to our hotel room. At the very least, it'll be a nice escape. He'll return to Amsterdam the next morning. On day 14, there's a massive storm and a freak rail service breakdown in Western Holland. Just as I arrive at the Brussels train station around 6 p.m., Simon calls to say that his train has been halted in Rotterdam. It's unclear which trains, if any, will leave from there. He might not get to Brussels tonight. He'll call me back. As if on cue, it starts to rain. I've carried the injection in a portable cooler with a cold pack that lasts only a few hours. What if I get caught in a hot train? I dash into a convenience store at the station, buy a bag of frozen peas, and shove them inside the cooler. Simon calls back to say there's a train leaving Rotterdam for Antwerp. Can I meet him in Antwerp? On the giant overhead screen, I see that there's a train leaving Brussels for Antwerp in a few minutes. In a scene where the Bourne identity meets Sex and the City, I grab my P-wrap syringe and bolt up to the platform. I'm in the rain, about to board the train to Antwerp, when Simon calls again. "Don't get on!" he shouts. He's on a train bound for Brussels. I take a taxi to our hotel, which is cozy and warm, and decked out for Christmas with a giant tree. I should be grateful just to be there, but the first room the bellhop brings me to doesn't quite have the conception vibe I'm looking for. He leads me to another room on the top floor with a slanted ceiling. This one seems like a good place to procreate. While I wait for Simon to arrive, I take a bath, put on a robe, then calmly jab myself with a syringe. I realize I wouldn't make a bad junkie. I hope, however, that I'll make an even better mother of two. A few weeks later, I'm in London for work. I buy a pregnancy test at a pharmacy, then I buy a bagel at a deli, for the sole purpose of using its dingy basement bathroom to take the test. Okay, I also eat the bagel. To my amazement, the test is positive. I call Simon while I'm pulling my suitcase to a meeting. He immediately starts choosing nicknames. Since the baby was conceived in Brussels, maybe we'll call him Sprout. Simon comes with me to an ultrasound a month later. I lie back on the table watching the screen. The baby looks wonderful. Heartbeat, head, legs. Then I notice a dark spot off to the side. What's that? I ask the doctor. She moves the wand over a bit. Suddenly, another little body pops onto the screen with its own heartbeat, head, and legs. Twins, she says. This is one of the best moments of my life. I feel like I've been given an enormous gift. Two pizzas. It also seems like a very efficient way for a woman in her late 30s to breed. When I turn to look at Simon, I realize that the best moment of my life may be the worst moment of his. He appears to be in shock. For once, I don't want to know what he's thinking. I'm giddy from the idea of twins. He's blown over by the enormity of it. I'll never be able to go to a cafe again, he says. Already he foresees the end of his free time. You could get one of those home espresso makers, the doctor suggests. My French friends and neighbors congratulate us on the news. They treat the reason of having twins as none of their business. The Anglophones I know are generally less discreet. Were you surprised? A mother in my playgroup asks when I announce the news. When I offer an unrevealing yes, she tries again. Well, was your doctor surprised? I'm too busy to be bothered. Simon and I have decided that what we really need isn't a better coffee maker. It's a larger apartment. Our current one has just two small bedrooms. This seems even more urgent when we discover that the babies are both boys. I trek out to see several dozen apartments, all of which are either too dark, too expensive, or have long, scary hallways leading to tiny kitchens. Apparently in the 19th century, it wasn't chic to smell food while the servants were cooking it. The real estate agents always boast that the place I'm about to see is very calm. This seems to be a prized quality in both French apartments and French children. All the focus on real estate keeps me from worrying too much about the pregnancy. I think I've also absorbed the French idea that there's no need to track the formation of each fetal eyebrow, though there are quite a few eyebrows in there to worry about. I do briefly indulge in some twin-specific angst, like about the babies being born prematurely. But mostly the health system does the worrying for me. Because it's twins, I get extra doctor's visits and sonograms. At each visit, the handsome radiologist points out baby A and baby B on the screen, then makes the same bad joke. You're not obliged to keep those names. I flash him my best micro-smile. This time around, it's Simon who's anxious about himself, not the babies. He treats each cheese plate as if it's his last. I revel in all the attention. Despite the free IVF, twins are still a novelty in Paris. I'm told that doctors often implant just one or two embryos. Within a few weeks, I'm visibly pregnant. By 6 months, it looks like I'm about to deliver. Even some maternity clothes are too tight. Soon it's clear, even to young children, that there's more than one baby in there. I also study up on the nomenclature. In French, twins aren't called identical or fraternal. They're called vrai or faux, real or fake. I get used to telling people that I'm waiting for two fake twin boys. I needn't have worried about my fake boys coming out early. At 9 months pregnant, I have two full-sized babies inside of me, each weighing nearly as much as Bean did. People point at me from cafe tables, and I can no longer climb stairs. If you want an apartment, go find one, I tell Simon. Less than a week later, after seeing exactly one apartment, he does. The apartment is old, even for Paris. It has no hallways and a triple-wide sidewalk in front. It needs a lot of work. We buy it. The day before I give birth, I meet with an architect to plan the renovations. The private hospital where I delivered Bean was small and spotless, with an around-the-clock nursery, endless fresh towels, and steak and foie gras on the room service menu. I barely had to change a diaper. I've been warned that the public maternity hospital where I'm planning to deliver the twins will be a less rarefied experience. The medicine is excellent at French public hospitals, but the service is supposedly no frills. They give you a list of things to bring to the birth, which includes diapers. There's no customizing with birth plans, bathtubs, and walking epidurals. They don't give the baby a chic little hat. People keep saying conveyor belt to describe the efficient but impersonal experience. I opt for Hôpital Armand Trousseau because it's a 10-minute taxi ride from our house, and it's equipped to handle complications with twins. I later learned that it's attached to the children's hospital where Françoise Dautot did her weekly rounds. I don't want to give birth in a bathtub anyway, and I figure that when the moment comes, I'll just use my New York chutzpah to customize things. I point out to Simon that we're already enjoying economies of scale. They're going to deliver our two babies for the price of one. When I go into labor, the epidural isn't optional. The doctor puts me in a sterile operating room so he can do a C-section instantly if necessary. I'm flat on my back, my legs locked into a retro 1950s harness, surrounded by strangers in shower caps and surgical masks. I ask several times for someone to put pillows under my back so I can see what's happening. No one even responds. Eventually, in a small concession, someone shoves a folded sheet under me, which just makes me more uncomfortable. As soon as active delivery starts, my French evaporates. I can't understand anything the doctor says, and I can only speak English. This must have happened before, because a midwife immediately begins interpreting between me and the doctor. Maybe she's summarizing, or maybe her English isn't great, but she mostly just says push and don't push. When the first baby emerges, the midwife hands him to me. I'm captivated. Here is baby A at last. We're just getting acquainted when the midwife taps me on the shoulder. Excuse me, but you must deliver the other baby, she says, taking baby A to an undisclosed location. I realize right then that having twins is going to be complicated. 9 minutes later, baby B emerges. I say a quick hello, and then they whisk him away too. In fact, soon almost everyone is gone. Simon, the babies, and most of the enormous medical team. I'm still on my back, paralyzed from the waist down. My legs are up in the harness, spread wide apart. On a stainless steel table in front of me are two red placentas, each the size of a human head. Someone has decided to open the dividing curtains that were the walls of my room, so now anyone who walks past has a bull's-eye view of my 5 minutes post-twins crotch. The only person still with me is the anesthesia nurse, who also isn't thrilled about being left behind. She decides to mask her irritation by making small talk. Where am I from? Do I like Paris? Where are my babies? When can I see them? I ask. My French has reappeared. She doesn't know, and she's not allowed to leave me to find out. 20 minutes pass. No one comes for us. Perhaps because of the hormones? None of this bothers me, though I'm grateful when the nurse finally uses surgical tape to put up a little modesty cloth between my knees. After that, she no longer wants to chat. I hate my job, she says. Eventually someone wheels me into a recovery room where I reunite with Simon and the babies. We take pictures, and for the first and only time, I attempt to nurse both boys at once. An orderly wheels us to the room where the boys and I will be staying for the next few days. A boutique hotel, it's not. It's more like a Motel 6. There's a skeletal staff to help out, and a nursery that's open from about 1 to 4 a.m. Because I have an older child and am thus deemed unable to mess up too badly, the staff leaves me practically on my own. At mealtimes, someone brings in plastic trays with a parody of hospital food. Limp French fries, chicken nuggets, and chocolate milk. It takes me a few days to realize that none of the other mothers are eating this. There's a communal refrigerator down the hall, where they store groceries. Simon is home looking after Bean, so most of the time I'm alone with the boys, who howl for hours at a stretch. I usually wedge one between my legs, in some approximation of a hug, while I try to nurse the other. With the constant blur of noise and body parts, it feels like there are more than two of them. When I finally get them both to sleep after hours of wailing and drinking, Simon shows up. "It's so peaceful in here," he says. I try not to think about the fact that my belly looks like a giant mound of flesh-colored jello. Amid all this, we have to name the boys. The city of Paris gives you 3 days. By day two, an angry bureaucrat marches into your hospital room holding a clipboard. Simon asks only that Nelson is somewhere in the mix, after his hero, Nelson Mandela. Mostly he's worried about selecting the perfect nicknames. He wants to call one boy Gonzo and the other Chairman.